Hey, GeoTrekkers, this is Dr. Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. Welcome to a new episode. I think you're really going to enjoy this one if you're into resiliency. It's a big theme that we talk about on the podcast. How can we make our communities more resilient to extreme weather, to natural disasters, to these other trials and hardships that our communities face? Well, today on the podcast, we have a special guest, Melissa Beaudry. She's the senior resilience planner at HAF, an engineering firm that improves lives and communities by turning ideas into reality. This is a really hopeful and encouraging message for those of you that say, look, we would love to build more resiliency or do something new in our community, but we are stretched so thin. Our budget is thin, our personnel, our manpower is thin. We just can't really take on something new. This is really a message of hope and encouragement that a lot of what you're already doing may be resiliency, and taking a little bit of insight and expertise to come alongside you could help you take the next step to be even more resilient to overcome hardships you may face in the future. Well, before we get into this conversation with Melissa, I just wanted to introduce the podcast for new listeners. The GeoTrek podcast explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disaster not covered by the mainstream media. We're interested to investigate stories about the physical processes behind these extremes, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of these events to make ourselves more resilient and minimize loss of life and property as well. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us on this adventure. We're always going to a different part of the globe and taking different perspectives on the podcast. We're quite adventurous, and we try to bring you the latest content as well. This podcast is completely free. However, we do ask if you'd kindly subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Your subscription helps us mark professional progress, which makes it easier for us to make partnerships moving ahead and ensures many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. Well, without further introduction, let's get into this conversation with Melissa, where we're really going to investigate how we can make ourselves more resilient. Melissa, thanks so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Hal. Thanks for having me.
Well, we met recently at the Gulf of Mexico conference in Tampa, and I definitely wanted to bring you on the podcast. You had a lot of insights there at the conference. How was the conference for you?
Oh, it was great. It was good to be back in my home state of Florida, being now in Texas. So it was fun to be in Tampa and see a lot of old colleagues from my work across the state of Florida, and just see the really interesting cutting edge technology and data analytics that are being done in the Gulf of Mexico space. So
Great. No, there were so many great presentations. I really enjoyed talking to you with your background as a planning consultant and learning that, you know, you're a senior resilience planner at HAF. And I was just, you know, thinking with all this experience you have in the field, could you kind of explain to our listeners like the professional path you took to get where you are today?
Yeah, this question is always hard because my path doesn't really make all that much sense, but the more people I talk to, the more I hear that. So I guess it's good to be reassured that the drunken walk, as I call it, that got me to being a resilience planner all makes sense in the long run. So I started in college. I guess I really knew the overarching thing I wanted to do in life was just make people's lives better. And so I started, my first degree was in psychology, and I thought I was going to do private practice therapy and counseling. And then I realized I have too much ADHD to sit in a room and just listen to support. So then I went into community development and focused on international development rights. And I did some work in East Africa and other parts around the world and really enjoyed that. It was eye-opening. But I also felt like I needed to really focus in on my community back in the US, and that there were ways that I could support with community development nationally. And so I got a master's level certification in urban and regional planning. And then my first job out of college was at UNC Chapel Hill, teaching in their leadership department, which was really a way for me to continue studying but have the university pay for it. And so I got a master's certification in nonprofit management. And so I thought I wanted to like work in, you know, nonprofits in the States and do community development. I did that for a while in Florida, in Jacksonville, my hometown. I moved back and worked for a land trust, which is a great organization that works with landowners to conserve lands under conservation easement or acquisition. And in my from how I viewed it, because I worked in both the urban and rural settings in Florida, is that the more we can preserve and protect the critical ecosystems, the more we can allow for smart development in where people live and thrive, and find that balance of living with the natural environment. And so I worked on some urban waterway restoration projects and some other projects that really intersected climate justice and climate equity within the space of conservation. And then from there, I got connected with a grant writing firm in Jacksonville that was working on the BP Gulf oil spill project with a group of consultants for the state of Florida. And I was like, I remember being in college when the oil spill happened and being kind of a student organizer around it and wanting to do something. And so when I got connected with them and they were working on it, I found that to be a good nexus. I had a lot of grant writing experience from the nonprofit sector, but also the public, you know, urban planning side. And so I melded those together and worked with the biologists and engineers on the state recovery efforts from the BP Gulf oil spill. So I worked mostly on the pot of funding that was really post recovery. So I wasn't directly cleaning up, dealing with any of the, you know, oil or direct outfalls from the oil spill, but more the funding that was coming down to each of the states from the civil penalties. So long-term recovery efforts. So environmental and economic recovery all across the Gulf Coast of Florida, which was 23 counties that all have Gulf shorelines. So those are a lot of those friends that were there at the conference at GOMCON, who I got to reconnect with, which was great. But all of that to say, it was it's been kind of a journey. And once I really got into that project and worked in grant writing across the state of Florida, I just saw how critical hazard mitigation was playing a role in every stage of development and in Florida, right? I mean, we're constantly thinking about the next hurricane. Maybe not enough, but there's a lot of folks that are definitely thinking in that way. And so I just started to learn more about resilience and the way that we can adapt our infrastructure in order to not have to mitigate as heavily on the back end, as opposed to just waiting for the next hurricane and knowing that we're going to have to pay out, you know, billions of dollars. Can we make some innovations and change the way we plan for communities that will decrease the amount that we end up having to mitigate on the back end? So that's really what I started to see as this pattern and wanted to get to the end of.
Yeah, Melissa, you know, it's interesting. You start talking about Gulf Coast or the coast of Florida and resilience planning. Immediately, people are going to think it's just preparing for the next hurricane, right? But then it sounds like a lot of these other projects you got involved with, like the BP oil money that came in through the grant system, from what I've heard, that was very diverse and used in a lot of different ways to help communities, right?
Yeah. And that's just how resilience is. Resilience can really touch so many parts of our lives. I mean, not only is it evaluating all the different hazards, so everything from extreme heat to, yes, storm surge and sea level rise, but also, I mean, when we're doing real large scale vulnerability assessments, we're also taking into consider cybersecurity and terrorism. All of those are potential hazards to a community, and all of those have to be taken into consideration for how to build back better is right, the term that is often used in resilience. And so, yeah, that BP money was used for economic investments and, you know, creating new industries, and all of that helps make a community more resilient, because what we found with the oil spill was that communities that were reliant on a single industry like shrimping or oysters or, you know, something that was tied to the biodiversity of the Gulf, they were hit extremely hard by that, by the Gulf oil spill, because they had everything, you know, tied into that one specific thing. And so taking resilience into consideration and the different qualities of resilience, one of those is redundancy. And so the more multifaceted your economy can be, especially a small community, the more ability you'll have in order to be reflexive and kind of, you know, have different components of your economy and your community to be able to rely on in times of issues where a hazard might hit only one portion of that and the others can kind of take the brunt of it.
So. Well, Melissa, some of what you're touching on there is almost like economic planning as well. It sounds like you're saying these communities that only rely on seafood or tourism or just one sector, they're maybe more vulnerable if something hits that sector. So is there really wisdom in becoming more redundant or more diverse, I should say, economically for some of these coastal communities?
100%. I mean, the thing is, the more that you can, if you've got a coastal community that it relies on the ability for folks to travel and for this, the physical infrastructure along the coastline to be 100% good to go, then you are continuously at risk. And those communities know it. I mean, they don't need me to come in there and tell them. They know that they are hoping and praying every hurricane season. That often also coincides with summer vacation and Labor Day weekend and all these different times when you've got a huge influx of people that come for tourism reasons down to the coast. And if they're coming from the north and they're not familiar with how to evacuate during a hurricane, you've got an added layer there. Not only could it impact the businesses that rely on those tourists, but if tourists do come and get stuck in a time of emergency, it's then they then become the responsibility of that community to help get to safety. So there's so many different layers where the coast is our treasure, and it's what these communities are so grateful for, and it's why we love them. But it can also be a huge risk if not thought through.
Yeah, I've heard people describe it like high risk, high reward. I mean, some of the most beautiful areas in our country are on the coast, but with that come really enhanced hazards as well. So I wanted to ask you, how does planning tie into this for disaster loss reduction? Like when you think about planning and helping communities get ahead of these things, what does that entail?
So we really want to start with what we call vulnerability assessment is usually how if we like, we could just go into any community and money, budget wasn't an issue. It would be great to start with what's called a vulnerability assessment, where you're looking at all of the diverse hazards, you know, a lot of the ones we've just talked about here on the call, and you're evaluating that community's level of risk to those hazards. And that is done with an equation based on the level of exposure to that said hazard and the sensitivity it has to that hazard. So those are two different variables that get determined based on the geographic orientation, things like economic disparity, and also so social vulnerability, economic disparity, issues around redundancy, all of that gets played into it. And then really it's just about, what is that overall risk to the community and how vulnerable are they to potential hazards? So first we would start there. And then once we're able to identify where their greatest areas of risk are, then we can think through what the potential adaptations could be taken in order to prevent that potential risk and not have, again, mitigation on the back end. We want to mitigate that risk and find adaptive pathways for the community. And so that can be projects that would strengthen the road systems or the critical infrastructure. We call it hardening the critical infrastructure to make sure that in times of emergency, it stays up and running. Or it could be, we're a big fan of green infrastructure and nature-based solutions. So it could be having on those coastal communities, living shorelines implemented along the shoreline that really allow for the continuation of the natural setting that's so beautiful, but can really slow down that wave development and support for storm surge and other impacts from compound flooding. And so flooding's the biggest issue. A lot of our vulnerability looks around different aspects of flooding and water resources. We like to take a one water approach with our communities, which is looking at the nexus of flooding and drought. It's really big in Texas. And so again, all of those kind of understanding of what the actual risk is, then thinking through those potential adaptations, especially where you can find co-benefits. So if you have the ability to implement a project that can not only support with the reduction of flooding, so if you've got a increased green infrastructure for retention of water, then you're helping reduce the amount of runoff and sediment from flooding, but you can also help retain that water and utilize that in the local ecosystem to then support on a somewhat scale the drought issues that happen a lot of times in communities where you have both. So things like that are really fun to think through. I think that's where there's a lot of innovation in that space around potential adaptation techniques. And at GOMCON, a lot of the data analytics that came out can really help strengthen that vulnerability assessment side, understanding the new kind of modeling efforts that are out there across the board. Again, a lot on flooding, a lot on extreme heat, which is a really big one that everyone's trying to figure out. What are the different variables and analytics that we can look at in extreme heat? And all of that plays into the big picture. So, and then from the adaptation, that's where it can then get into working with policymakers. If some of those adaptive needs are on a policy side, if it's a code enforcement. So when you're talking about damage risk reduction, it can be how are we monetizing, identifying damage on the back end? How are we, what's the process for working with community members to pay out any damages? So there's policies around that that I think are really helpful to understand in the adaption process. And then where is there the opportunity for, again, there's things like managed retreat and home elevation programs. There's these different things that we're trying to look at from a policy side on the front end that I think can also help with that mitigation on the back end. So I think overall, the biggest thing when it comes to disaster risk reduction is the more that we can make this data available and in a way that is digestible to the public, and that they can have agency over their own decision-making around their housing and their future. I think the problem is when it's only FEMA's flood insurance program that people are really understanding their risk, and that's really all they have to go off of. They're in a mindset of their insurance, and they're coming at it from a mindset of as a homeowner. And so they're really taking kind of that economic lens to it. But if we had the availability to do vulnerability assessments for communities across the board, then I think that that could help community members, homeowners, people both in the policy decision and just everyday citizens have a more informed decision about what life looks like in their community and what they need to be on the lookout for potential hazards.
Melissa, you mentioned doing like vulnerability assessments with communities. I often hear communities say, oh, it's been 5 years. We have to do our new comp plans, our comprehensive plans. So are vulnerability assessments part of the comprehensive plan, or are those two separate things? Could you kind of give us some perspective on that?
Yeah, I think a vulnerability assessment would be great as a part of a comprehensive plan. Oftentimes comprehensive plans will have a existing conditions section is one of the first sections and parts of the process in the planning process. And I think that those could be strengthened a lot. And that's on, that's half as a consulting firm, we're doing that. We're integrating hazard analysis into our existing conditions section, but that's going to take time. And that's where, not to give the inside scoop away to other consultants, but if it's best for the communities, I think everyone when doing these comp plans for communities should be incorporating a hazards analysis into that first stage, that data analysis section of a comp plan. But it's definitely not necessary by law in any way. So it's one of those things where it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
Where
so have you seen like disaster prone communities, they're doing a comp plan and you're thinking you really should have a vulnerability assessment or a hazards analysis in there, but they're maybe thinking it's too much time, too much money, or just maybe not doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think this comes down to the answer is yes, but also I think it's important to note that things like resilience that are kind of new and they have a lot of buzzwords around them. It's important to note that there are communities that have already been doing a hazard analysis to some degree in their planning efforts. So communities that know that they are at risk of sea level rise and flooding, they're probably talking about it in some of their planning efforts in various ways. And communities that face wildfires and droughts, that's probably already going to be front of mind. So whether it's called out in a full blown hazard analysis, or it's just kind of part of that existing conditions that everyone already knows about, they know about the flood from 40 years ago that everyone talks about and really changed the landscape of the community, things like that. Those shocks to their system are probably already in their train of thought. But I think an important thing that we're seeing with the impacts of climate change are that more hazards and on a more severe level are facing our communities every day. I mean, in Texas, we've got freezes coming in as well as record heat, right? So where communities in the past are maybe used to that heat side, we all associate Texas with heat. We now have to have communities that are planning for these extreme cold snaps. And so that's where that historical data might not be enough for future planning. And so that's where, yes, I think that they kind of are doing a bit of a hazards analysis for the ones that they know, but it would be great to do kind of a big picture analysis of all potential hazards. And that's where we'd like to take folks into the future.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? A big part of this is just keeping communities from being blindsided by things they might get hit by that they weren't expecting.
Yeah, and the more we can create policies that are adaptive in nature, Because the thing is, we can plan for all the hazards we know today, but so much of the process of thinking more resilient is that we'll never know all of the future potential hazards to come. So the more we can get a framework of thinking adaptive and on the spot and having these flexible components of both the physical infrastructure and the programs and policies that people operate under, the more we can try and be prepared for whatever future disasters end up hitting our communities. So,
Melissa, what do your conversations look like when you get in with communities and they're like, you know, resiliency planning sounds great. We're on a tight budget. We can't afford it. It's outside our scope. It's outside our budget. I mean, what are some of those conversations look like, and how can you help people kind of look at the bigger picture?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of our local governments face on a daily basis, is trying to find a balanced budget and provide all the key services. So we're always looking for creative ways to embed resilience into existing plans and policies. Things like you mentioned, the comprehensive plan, most communities are going to have a component to that at city level. And then counties do what's called a hazard mitigation plan. And so that's a great planning tool that, again, focuses on kind of emergency response and mitigation efforts, but is another great tool that really does identify hazards and potential mitigation. So depending on which level of government, there can be an existing planning system where we could embed more resilient efforts into it. But it will take a kind of different level of effort, or kind of including a real intentional inclusion of resilience components into those existing planning documents. So our goal when I was studying my urban resilience at a program in Barcelona with the UN Habitat, our real goal when we were going through the whole program is, how can we embed resilience into daily functions of city government? And that was kind of the main goal of the program. So that's what we're trying to do every day, is not necessarily have to have $500,000 shiny new plan that communities have to undertake, but how do we make it a part of everyday lives?
Well, and it sounds like maybe coming alongside them on things they're already doing, right?
Yeah. And that's, so we're doing, when it comes to embedding resilience, I mean, I'm doing that every day in my job of working with engineers who have been, perfecting their skills for the last 30, 40 years and constantly innovating. It's me looking at ways in which they're currently doing resilience in their work and calling it by name and finding ways for them to take it even further. And we do the same thing with our communities. So again, as I said, there's some that are already identifying their hazards and their comprehensive planning. How do we call that by name and say that when you are looking at, you know, that storm that hit 20 years ago and that fire from 30 years ago, and you're thinking about these roads that are key evacuation routes, you're doing resilience planning, and how can we kind of frame that and take it to the next level? So a big part of it, yeah, is definitely working alongside them and showing them the ways in which they're already doing it and can do it even better.
From conversations I've had with planners, with local government officials, emergency management coordinators, something I picked up too is that they may hire outside consultants to help, but there's a danger in just, you know, passing the baton to an outside group and saying, write a plan and put it on our desk, right? I hear this concept that if local government's involved every step of the way and they have more ownership, that's a lot more beneficial in the long run. Could you give us some perspective on that? Like, why having the local government involved in writing that, maybe even if they're hiring outside consultants, why really should there be a dialogue, and why is that beneficial moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great point. And as an outside consultant, it's one of those things where we try to be cognizant of that all the time, where we don't want to just be the hired consultant that comes in and writes a plan that sits on a shelf and then we leave. At HAF, we've grown organically and we've tried to be trusted advisors, but that takes really strong stakeholder engagement. That takes knowing the communities you're working with, knowing who those individuals are that are key stakeholders, not only within the government system, but also within the community. And that's a big piece too, is that oftentimes we're hired by the local government, whether it's the city or the county, and they need the opportunity to reach out to the community members too, to get input on city practices. So these planning processes can often be that time where there's this facilitated dialogue between the community and the city officials to really come up with a well-rounded plan and overall solutions for the community. But I think one of the things that we've found in trying to do intensive stakeholder engagement is, when we talk about those hazards, we can kind of come up with this high level understanding of all the different hazards that might face a community But the individuals who have lived in that community, they're going to have the best data on that storm that came through 40 years ago. And they're going to have contextualized information that's not going to show up on any model, and it's not going to show up on any of the past reports, you know? And so the more that you can go and engage with the community and really understand on the ground what's happening, the more you can really dig into what the actual problem is and come up with those adaptive solutions that will actually make a change and not just be kind of a recipe of a potential infrastructure solution that doesn't really make sense for the community you're looking at. So that's where, as an outside consultant, you know, we can bring in the expertise and the kind of, you know, technical knowledge, but it takes that in-person, real life lived experience in order to make it implementable and actually successful for the community. And I'll say too, that the more we do that, while sometimes it might cost more money in a planning process to have really robust engagement, it oftentimes will lead to more success in implementation, because then folks feel like they were a part of the process. As you were saying, like, they really feel that they have ownership over it. And it's not just for lip service. Like, they really, if they really are a part of it, then they will know how to implement it. And so it won't be a plan that's just on a shelf. It'll be something that they're thinking about every day that they move through life.
You know, something else that stands out to me is then, you know, you're doing a bullseye and really hitting the issues that concern them, because sometimes scientists say, okay, these are the issues this community needs to be concerned about. And they're saying, maybe in this particular case, we're not concerned about sea level rise right now, but between 3rd and 8th Street, it floods every month during a downpour. Maybe the outside scientists don't know that, but the locals are saying this is becoming a major issue to us, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or it's like, yeah, it's a coastal community. I mean, take the Lower Rio Grande Valley, where I'm doing a good bit of work. You've got huge compound flooding there, where the river is flooding. You've got really poor, in some parts, poor drainage infrastructure. And so you've got this major stormwater issue. And so people would think, oh, it's in the coastal Texas. They're worried about hurricanes and sea level rise. And it's like, well, most of the coastline is national refuge or vacation homes, you know, and that's not the bulk of the community that's in need. It's really, you know, in your interior communities that have not enough drainage infrastructure to support just the rainstorm that's going to happen. I mean, obviously, when the hurricanes move through, they do move through the entire community, and they are without a doubt a major issue for all of the valley. But it's those shocks to the system, but it's the everyday stresses to the system, like a big rainstorm in the summer, that continuously knocks down that infrastructure. And so, yeah, you're right. That commercial corridor that completely shuts down and screws up everyone's day for a couple of days, those are the big impacts too. We can't forget that.
Well, Melissa, let's talk a little more about those projects you're working on there in the Lower Rio Grande River Valley. I believe this is one of the communities you said that an evacuation plan was made, and it actually involves pedestrian evacuation of them walking out of the danger zones. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's a very innovative project that the Texas GLO, the General Land Office, has funded and is putting on. Or we're supporting them with the study to understand in times of flash flooding. So again, that can be during heavy rainstorms where the river and different systems will all create compound flooding. How can we get individuals who are pedestrian, whether they were pedestrian in the moment because it's a flash flood, or that is their only mode of transportation is by foot, how do we get them to higher ground and to a safe evacuation point in those times of emergency? And so it's been about a year and a half process, and we're in the last couple of months doing the study with the GLO. But the really interesting part is understanding the different layers of social vulnerability in how individuals that are in this very dynamic community. The Lower Rio Grande Valley is a very heavily, densely populated area. In a lot of the cities, and then it's still got a lot of farmland, and it's got very rural areas as well. So it's very unique in its development. And there's also a large amount of what's called colonias, which is a federal designation, and it's areas that, and I'm going to get the year wrong, but many years ago, folks were able to kind of take on land and build home structures in these designated areas of colonias. with the promise that there was going to be, you know, additional sewer and electrical and utilities brought into the community by the government. And then that didn't happen. And so these communities are still underdeveloped and underfunded, undersupported. And so it's a huge social vulnerability issue. It's something that the counties in this area are very aware of and try to support. But it's something that when you have issues like flooding, it more severely impacts those areas that don't have proper infrastructure. And so you've got this kind of compounding issue now of the vulnerability for those folks. And so, again, those are our population that likely are needing to evacuate by foot. So trying to get them from low-lying areas without proper drainage to an elevated area. And that's whether it's a trail system existing or one that we're promoting through this study. Getting them to an evacuation site where there's other emergency management responders that can support them either by boat or by bus. There's a couple different ways that we're trying to look at what that actual evacuation route ends up looking like. But the biggest issue that we're finding is that in trying to create a route, you've got such widespread flooding on the roadways that without creating, you know, like an elevated trail system all across the city, it's really difficult to find what those routes can look like that are elevated. So what we've come back to time and time again in the study is that it comes down to proper drainage, and that we need to improve the drainage system to be able to support more capacity. That's clearly happening on a regular basis in this area. And then, you know, then from there, be able to create the infrastructure for pedestrian traffic. But it's kind of a need for the infrastructure first.
It sounds a bit complex with a few different variables. There's the drainage issue and then possibly some pedestrian evacuation if you can get better drainage. And I'd imagine that there are some areas there with some good topographic relief where people maybe can get up on hillsides and things like that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, to the scale that we could, I mean, that's definitely the goal, is even just to get them to a temporary mustering location. And we've, you know, come up with some potential solutions around shelter systems that utilize emergency call boxes, so that if folks get to a certain shelter location that's kind of remote, that emergency responders will know that they're there. Because that was our other worry, is, okay, we're going to create these trail designations, but then who knows that they're there and they need support if it's, you know, just in a more rural area. And so we've thought through the potential to implement kind of a regional response system. And we've been working with the emergency managers to get their input on if that would be a potential solution. All of this is very much in the planning stage, but that's the goal, is just kind of coming up with ideas of what could be supportive.
Well, that's fascinating. And obviously a very vulnerable population there. A lot of people that may not understand emergency message in English, things like that. I think you and I started talking about this. We were talking about Spain, actually. And I was just recently in Spain. I was in the only tsunami ready city in Spain, Chipiona, Spain. And they said, we can evacuate 100,000 people in an hour. I said, there's no way. And they said, we can do it, but it's not reliant on cars. It's reliant on people getting up in the hillsides and really a pedestrian evacuation. I had never heard of anything like that. And then when you and I were talking in Tampa, you mentioned what's going on in the lower Rio Grande. And you also mentioned you spent a considerable amount of time in Spain and did a graduate studies in Barcelona, right?
I did. Yeah. I love that story that you shared of that tsunami ready town. I wish I'd known about it. Maybe I could have gone and done a little research for this project there. But I spent 8 months in Barcelona for the master's program that I mentioned in urban resilience and city management. So it was very unique program that was created in partnership with UN Habitat and the Rockefeller Foundation, which the Rockefeller Foundation has funded the Resilient Cities program they've moved away from it now, but for 10 plus years, I think, they funded chief resilient officer positions in key cities around the world, funded the salaries for the first couple of years with the intention of, you know, then the cities would take on that and include it in their budget. And that has been an extremely successful program. And there are still chief resilience officers in major cities to this day and will hopefully be there into the future. So really interesting program, a lot of cutting edge researchers and professors and practitioners were kind of all of our guest lecturers, and was just a really great way to see what's happening on the global scale. I think, you know, you mentioned the difference between what planning in the States looks like versus planning in Europe. And I think that's such a great example that you shared in Spain of the tsunami ready city, because it can't be reliant on cars, because their infrastructure is not made with major highways that run through the middle of the cities. It's ancient. And so I think when I was learning about the different planning efforts happening in Europe, it was unique to see that their goal was to support the community, but do it in a way that honored the integrity of the historical environment. So knowing that, you know, you can't just bulldoze down these buildings in order to build, you know, a major thoroughfare or, you know, whatever kind of structure you're thinking of, they really, I think, find more innovative ways to find solutions within their existing infrastructure. But it also creates a whole other slew of you know, hurdles that you have to jump over. And I think that those pressure points lead to innovation. So it's been really interesting, especially I worked a lot with the university in Delft in Netherlands. And so IAG Delft is where the UN Water Institute is based, and Delterres and some other very innovative water related programs. And so to just learn from the Dutch who have, you know, dealt with flooding and water and had to learn to live with water. I know that that's something that communities like Houston have really spent a lot of time learning how the Dutch have integrated water management into their everyday lives. And that's something that we continue to learn from.
Well, that's really true. And a lot of these communities, especially overseas, have been maybe dealing with these issues for hundreds of years, right? And so we could maybe tap into that knowledge that they have, whether that's in the Sahara Desert or the Netherlands or Barcelona or wherever, and maybe use some of that knowledge and experience they have to help us here in the States.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we're still babies when it comes to being a country. And so I think we're such a unique ecosystem in the U.S. And so we have a lot of unique situations and a lot to offer, but a lot to learn as well. So.
Melissa, you mentioned nature-based solutions. Do you see a lot of communities requesting that? Or is that just something that's really becoming part of the dialogue now for flood resilience or preparing for other hazards?
Yeah, I definitely think it's growing in its understanding both in the industry and in the public. In the industry, I'll say that one of the major ways that we're seeing it is through the Army Corps of Engineers. They have a program called Engineering with Nature that's been in development for 20 years. And they're putting a lot of effort into nature-based solutions and green infrastructure as the potential solutions that they want to see analyzed and implemented through their funding sources and through their efforts. So that's, I mean, to have somebody as strong as the Army Corps as a leader in this space is, I think, really speaks volume. As well as programs like the BRIC program, the Building Resilient Infrastructure in Communities, that was a coordinated effort between EPA, FEMA, and I think the Army Corps with other federal agencies. They really also are emphasizing nature-based solutions, and that's a huge funding opportunity for local communities. And then we are seeing at the local level, it's more from the perspective on often of communities that have that really value their green space currently, their park systems, and they see it as a major part of their quality of life, then they're already kind of understanding of the impacts that green infrastructure and low impact development can have on both supporting the infrastructure needs of a community while maintaining that kind of open space quality of life. And so it's harder when that isn't already maybe ingrained in the community. It's also harder when you've got bigger communities that, you know, they've got a lot of infrastructure to maintain. So coming up with new innovative solutions that change their status quo, it's just harder. It'll be harder no matter what the innovation is. But Houston, for example, as a big community, they have taken a leadership in creating a green infrastructure handbook for their stormwater management. And so we're working on that project as well with them right now. And that could lead to huge innovations for the infrastructure across the city.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, some of these bigger cities too, I mean, they have so many people impacted and sometimes they have a lot of resources to work with, I would imagine, to innovate some of these solutions.
Yeah, definitely have to innovate. And then there, Houston would be one of those cities where they kind of feel the need to innovate because they're so heavily impacted by flooding that they know they have to do something. And so they're looking at large scale transformational innovation as well as kind of the green infrastructure, smaller scale impacts along the way. And so you know, it costs a lot of money every time a roadway gets flooded or continuously flooded and erodes that infrastructure. So I think for those communities that are bigger and they feel the financial impact, they know that they need to make innovation and solutions made possible.
Well, Melissa, we covered a lot in this podcast. I learned a lot from you, from the lower Rio Grande Valley to Spain, to East Africa, to Houston. I mean, we covered a lot, and a lot of what you shared as well that is really applicable for a lot of Gulf Coast communities. Before we wrap up the podcast, I wanted to ask you one last question. What's one take-home message that you'd really like to share with our listeners? Just something that you've realized that, you know, really could help people become more resilient wherever they live.
Oh, big question. I think what I've really learned in resilience is that we can get caught up in what we call things sometimes, the buzzwords that we create. And it can sometimes, if you're learning about something new and it feels too advanced or too heady, we can kind of turn turn away from it. And so I think what I've tried to do with resilience and how I implement it is just look at what people are already doing successfully. Look at how innovation has happened naturally over the course of human existence, how people have learned to adapt. I mean, humans, we are resilient creatures in and of ourselves. And so we can learn from our own past. We can learn from nature and just try to take chances. I think that's the thing that I would love for communities and for individuals is, Not the high risk, high reward, maybe, but definitely be open to looking at new adaptive ways. And I think the other biggest thing is that in any time of disaster, what we find time and time again is even if the infrastructure is hardened and secure, if there isn't strong community resilience, if you don't have a communication network, if you don't have people to rely on, it can still fall apart very easily. And so the biggest thing that we can do is band together, support each other, and communicate along the way.
That's a good point. I mean, the social infrastructure sometimes is just as important as the physical. And I like what you said, too, about resiliency can sound scary, but sometimes within a community, you help to teach me they're already doing a lot of these things. Or maybe in a nearby community, you can find what practices are already in place that are really creating resiliency, even if it wasn't called that, like, you know, using that buzzword, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we got to tear down the buzzword walls and the kind of heady piece and make sure that we're the solutions we're coming up with are for everyone everywhere. So,
well, Melissa, thanks so much for taking time to come on the podcast. Best wishes to you and your future endeavors. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot about what you're doing with HAF. I know you're very tied in with a lot of different communities and really academia, government, nonprofit. I think you're very tied in a lot of places. So I'm sure we'll cross paths a lot in the future.
Yeah, I hope so, Hal. Thank you so much. This is great.
Melissa, thanks so much for sharing those insights. We covered so much great content on this episode. It's hard to even know where to start with a summary. There were three major points, though, that really stood out to me that I'm going to take away from this conversation. Number one was this concept of embedding resiliency into pre-existing systems or frameworks that communities already have in place. I thought this was genius, right? Because if we approach communities and say, you need to start something completely new, you need a complete overhaul of how you're doing things, a lot of communities, I think, are just going to face paralysis. They're going to be paralyzed and say, hey, we have limited resources. We can't do any of this. But by coming alongside them, encouraging what they're already doing well and helping them take a few next steps to even improve more, I think it's a genius way to improve resiliency in our communities. It reminds me a bit of when I was a snowboard coach back in upstate New York. We had a great teaching team and they would encourage us when someone comes to the mountain for the first time and they're doing a whole bunch of stuff really well, but they could use improvement on a few other things. A great way to start that conversation is to encourage the things they're already doing well, saying, this is amazing. I could tell you're athletic. I love how you're bending your knees. I love how you're really balancing your weight over the board. You're doing so much well already, but you're going to do even better if you just remember to keep your weight uphill, right? So again, you're starting by coming alongside them, encouraging the things they're already doing well. And I've noticed in those coaching conversations, the posture, all of a sudden their defense mechanism drops, this sense of defeat or shame drops, and they feel encouraged. Like, I can do this. That's a lot of the conversation and the perspective and really the posture I heard Melissa taking with these communities to say, you're already doing so much well. Let's call it by its name. Let's call all that resiliency work, and then let's look at ways that you can take a few next steps to improve what you're doing even more. So I really love that perspective, and I think it makes it more possible for communities. It takes away the paralysis, and they say, hey, we're already on the right track. Let's just keep on going. Number two, I love that Melissa gave us so many freebies here on really specific language and things that we can do to help communities improve their resiliency. She talked about creating vulnerability assessments and how those could fit into comp plans or comprehensive plans. And she talked about really a framework of what that looks like, identifying potential risks to a community. And then once we have those identified, really talking through different adaptation solutions, just really practical advice that communities can use, whether that's city government or counties or regional entities as well. She also talked about the value of creating hazard mitigation plans. We know that a lot of communities already do this, but depending on your community, you may or may not be doing these things. And it was really, I thought, insightful and very helpful for someone with so much experience to walk us through what these plans are and what they're comprised of. And these may be things, as she explained, really how she approaches it. Even if you're doing these things, maybe this gives you a different perspective on a different way to look at it or a different insight as well. Finally, I thought the conversation we had early in the podcast on the value of diversification was really insightful and I think really valuable. So she mentioned in the oil spill, the Gulf Coast oil spill many years back, a lot of these coastal communities that relied solely on seafood were hit really, really hard by the oil spill because they were not diverse enough. I saw this in COVID as well in a lot of the Gulf Coast communities that relied predominantly on tourism. When tourism was shut off, their economies collapsed. It's just a reminder that the more diverse and the more, I guess, multifaceted our economies can be, it really gives us some safety nets there. For years, I've been talking to coastal communities like, hey, let's develop some flood resiliency and technology and infrastructure. And some of these ideas that we're doing to help ourselves, let's build that into a flood resiliency industry or a flood technology industry and export that knowledge out and also build a business base here along the coast. Again, tourism is great in the Gulf. It's a great place to live. The seafood's off the chain, but it's good to diversify these things. And I hope some of these coastal communities can also develop maybe some technologies and some, you know, engineering practices, things like that. I would love to see more firms doing work with communities and exporting their knowledge beyond their community to create business as well. Well, Melissa, thanks again for coming on the podcast. Great to hear your insights. I know our listeners got a lot out of this episode. I wanted to thank our listeners as well for making us the number one podcast on the topic of natural disasters, according to FeedSpot. It's your support of our podcast. We have a lot of faithful listeners, and a lot of you have been sharing this content online, telling your friends and family about it. We just encourage you to keep up doing what you're doing. You're helping us a lot, and you're helping us help many disaster-prone communities to become more resilient. Everyone, stay safe wherever you are. Enjoy this beautiful spring weather. Try to get outside, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek Podcast.